All right, remember, the machine knows if you're lying. First statement, Carvana will give you a real offer on your car all online.
False.
True, actually. Oh. You can sell your car in minutes.
False? That's gotta be...
True again. Carvana will pick up your car from your door, or you can drop it off at one of their car vending machines.
Sounds too good to be true, so true!
Finally caught on. Nice job. Honesty isn't just their policy, it's their entire model. Sell your car today, too.
Carvana.
Pickup fees may apply.
Oh, the car from Carvana's here. Well, will you look at that? It's exactly what I ordered. Like, precisely. It would be crazy if there were any catches. But there aren't, right?
Right. Because that's how car buying should be. With Carvana, you get the car you want. Choose delivery or pickup, and a week to love it or return it.
Buy your car today with
Carvana.
Delivery or pickup fees may apply. Limitations and exclusions may apply. See our 7-day return policy at Carvana.com.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hey, everybody, it's Devin.
And Kate.
Welcome to Med Crimes.
Weekly Med Crimes. This has been nice, actually.
It has been nice. I see you a lot more.
Yeah.
I mean, can we go back to 4 years ago?
Yep.
I mean, how much did we see each other?
I actually can't believe it's been 4 years.
It's so cool.
I can't. I literally am beside myself that it's been 4 years. It's like
we've made like a new like little Sunday evening tradition now.
This is a tradition. Our kids are like such good friends.
It's awesome.
And I think a lot of it is because we do this.
They're up at the stairs having a Nintendo party.
It's incredible. This is amazing.
This is a trial weekend.
Yep.
Right now for my children with the Nintendo party because I'm really on the fence.
That's a big... These things are not cheap.
Give me those pros and cons, everyone, of...
Yep.
The video game world.
Yes.
We have not delved into it yet.
Well, it sounds
and
like
we are
might be.
On the fence for this upcoming holiday season.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
My kids don't listen to the show, so you know, I can say what I want.
Yes. Yes, you can.
Please send Kate all of your, and I say Kate, us, but
us.
Kate will send them to me.
Yes,
all
I will.
Of our, all of your pros and cons.
I am the middleman.
Of the video game world.
I am actually the middleman.
I'm currently in the sticker shock phase, so
yep.
I'm really like, eh.
Yeah, they're not cheap.
No, but it's all right.
So, yeah, it's good. I like, for me, it's like the family Mario Kart parties. Like, for me, that's the most fun. Like, mm-hmm. when we all get to, like, you know, sit and play games as a family. That's
yes.
my fun. That's my fun part.
Yes.
But, yeah.
Yes.
We have Patreons.
Da-da-da-da!
We have Julia Leon.
Hey, Julia Leon.
Julia Leon. Wow. Okay.
Sounds French.
Speaking
it does, of.
Actually.
The Louvre.
The Louvre?
Did you see?
No.
Got robbed?
What? Someone can rob the Louvre these days? It's 2025.
Thieves went in with like a basket weighted. Like, I don't know. They went in like via a basket or something from the roof and down and then they
Are you describing a literal movie right now? Because
I know.
Does
it sounds like
sound...
It sounds like a Nicolas Cage movie. But
what
it's
is
not,
going on?
So yeah, totally happened. And they sold millions of jewels.
how in this day and age can you rob a place like that? Just casually like fucking Louvre. Rob the Louvre.
Well, they did it in 7 minutes.
That is fucking crazy to me.
To be determined.
Yeah.
I mean, I found it on Facebook, so it's got to be real.
This is a med crime. I've just declared that I am having chest pains over it, therefore it is a med crime.
Who's our other French Patreon for us?
Maria Lamont. So actually, she also sounds kind of French. Yep.
For Julia Maria, Lyon. I was first going Italian, but then Lamont, we got the French.
Or if you're nasty, Lamont.
Oh.
Ooh. Right. If you're nasty.
Thank you to both Julia and Maria.
Oh, we love you guys. And
thank
I have
you,
a critter.
Thank you.
Ooh. You guys are vampires, but sexy ones, super powerful.
Like Edward Cullen?
Not sparkly.
Oh, he's sparkly.
But they only drink human blood if that human is like a garbage human, and they're delicious. Oh. But you're like the really sexy, awesome
This is
vampires.
A very specific type of vampire.
We love the crap out of you guys, and we say it a lot, but I don't feel like it's enough because we love you. Anyway, I love you. I'm saying it again because I do. I love you.
I love you.
We have a good one today, and I'm Devin does know not a lot of detail, but just like the gist.
I just know like the
she knows the gist.
Topic. So yeah, you did tell me the gist, but I other than the theme, I have no idea.
So I'm just going to like...
And I'm kind of excited that I know the theme just because that's fucking cool.
You finally actually know a theme. And I'm going to sort of like start going into it. And we're all probably going to be like, wait a minute, is this a med crime? This isn't really making a whole lot of sense. But then it will all come out and you'll be like, oh, I see why it's a med crime.
Okay,
It'll
I'm
be
ready.
Neato torpedo.
Get tucked in.
We do have a couple... Just one real big trigger warning, I would say, is like domestic violence. Basically. So with that, I'm going to get into it.
Grab your drink.
Grab your drink. Grab your butt.
Get curled up.
Hold on to your butt. Scott Fallader was the respected product engineer of Motorola. His wife, Yarmila, who went by Yarm, they had been together for ages and ages. Actually, they were high school sweethearts. We'll get into it a little bit. She was a stay-at-home mom to their two kids, 12-year-old Michael and 15-year-old Megan. And by 1997, Scott and Yarmila had been happily married for more than two decades. Like I said, they were high school sweethearts. They actually kind of grew up together, like they grew up in the same town. And according to friends and neighbors, they seemed like this picture-perfect couple. They were like, they were couple goals. They live their
Love
lives.
The stories that always seem that way.
Yeah, they do. Then, sometimes they all seem that way. And I feel like there's always something under the surface. So it's like always, you know, kind of impossible to really know. But they seemed so perfect from the outside. And their lives were also very deeply rooted in religion. And they were both born Catholic. But Scott and Yarmila actually both converted to the Mormon church before they got married. And then that became a huge like pillar in their lives. And that became like a sort of a central focus for the family. And according to their son, Michael, the Falladers were deeply involved in the LDS church, not just like church goers, but they were also very involved in like church functions and
LDS,
like the Latter-day Saints.
Got it.
Mormon church.
Yep.
So Scott even volunteered to teach early morning seminary classes. So like, he not only had like this really demanding job at Motorola, he was like every single morning teaching Bible study to kids, basically, in the mornings, like before going to work. So he was very, very busy guy. And he would teach his classes, like usually he was at the church by like 6 o'clock in the morning, would prep his class, teach his class, and then leave, bring his kids to school, and then go to work for the day. So like he had a very busy day to day. He kept a very, very tight schedule. And anybody looking in from the outside would say, these people are like super wholesome, very tight knit, sort of like American family goals type of thing. Nobody ever said that they ever saw anything or heard anything that would indicate otherwise. I mean, these people seemed to like really all have it together. You know, these were like any like neighbor family that you're close with that you're like, boy, I like love that family. I love them. I love their kids and like spend time with them.
You know who I'm pinpointing this to right now? And I don't know why, but this is giving me very like, and I'm sure this story is going to take a completely different turn.
Mm-hmm.
However, this is giving me very Joshua Duggar vibes.
Yes. Yes.
Right?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
It does take a different turn than that. But yeah,
of course,
I see what you mean.
That's the vibes that I'm getting.
But it's
there's
very
a,
much
there's
like
a,
the image.
There's the image, but then there's like a dark secret inside.
100%.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So
what's
now
this
comes
dark secret?
This now comes Thursday, January 16th, 1997. And by all accounts,
it was almost my birthday.
It was almost your birthday. Right. Like very close. So by all accounts, it was an ordinary night in the Fowler household. The family had had dinner together that Yarmila had cooked. It's something that they made a point to do during the week. They always made sure that, you know, no matter how busy everybody was, they always made sure that they at least gathered together and sat and had a meal together as a family. So they always made sure that they did that.
I need to get better at that.
Same, actually. Yeah. So that was something that was really important for them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they had dinner together, and afterwards, Scott was starting to prepare for the early morning Bible class that he was scheduled to teach the following day. So after dinner, he was, you know, sitting down at his desk and trying to gather things for his class that he was going to teach. And the kids, 15-year-old Megan and 12-year-old Michael, headed off to bed somewhere around 9. That was pretty normal for them. And then just before Scott turned in for the night, Yarmila had asked him for a favor. She said, actually, would you mind just going to take a look at the pool filter? Because their pool filter had been acting funny. It had been a really, really long day before any of this started. And he was like, oh, you're right. We do need to really figure that out and see if, you know, is something that I can fix or do we need to call somebody or whatnot? So at this point,
this seems like a very important detail before bed.
It is.
Got it.
He's like, okay, I'm going to go outside. I'm wiped. I'm exhausted. But she's been reminding me to do this for ages, and we do need to figure it out because, like, it's going to be pool season before you know it. We got to get the pool going. So he heads outside to the pool, and he takes a peek at it, and he's looking at the filter. He's like, I don't know. He's like, I'm cooked. I'm tired. I'm exhausted. I don't even know if I could figure it out, if what was wrong with it. I'm not, like, a pool person. So he kind of plays around with it a little bit. He's like, I don't think whatever it is, I'm not going to fix it tonight. Around 9:30, he comes back inside and he's kind of frustrated. He's exhausted and he's just ready to call it a night. So he kind of gave up. He walks back inside. Yarmila is like dozing off on the couch, like sort of waiting for him to come inside. So according to him, in his interview that he gave with ABC News later on, he said that he gently woke her up, he kissed her goodnight, and he apologized that, and he said, I'm sorry, I can't fix it tonight. I'm exhausted. I don't really know what's wrong with it, but like, I promise I will look at it and I will take care of it or call someone tomorrow. And he said then he marched upstairs and he fell into bed and he fell asleep. And that's where this story kind of takes a little bit of a turn.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Now, sometime later that evening, just after 10 o'clock, Scott's next-door neighbors, Greg and Sue, heard something strange. From their bedroom window, they picked up what sounded like either moaning or muffled crying. And it was faint, but it was enough that it made them kind of like look at each other and be like, well, that doesn't sound right. I don't love that. So they decided to go outside and take a closer look. And so Greg stepped outside. He peered over the fence that separated their two yards. And that's when he saw something lying near the pool. And it was very dark out, so it was hard for him to see exactly what it was. And it was Yarmila. And at first, Greg didn't like freak out. He thought maybe she had slipped and fallen, or that she like had something to drink and then had passed out like near the pool. He was like, you know, the first glance, he didn't really know what to think.
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't put it together. She had been like hurt in any way. And so something just didn't like feel right by the way she was like positioned. So he continued to kind of just like peer over and keep an eye. And then like moments after he saw that, Scott Fallader returns to the backyard. And according to Greg, who was still watching over the fence, Scott walked straight towards his wife, Yarmila. He grabbed her by the wrist and he dragged her closer to the water. And Greg says he watched Scott push her into the pool and then from the side of the pool, hold her head beneath the surface of the water.
So he's watching him.
So he's watching
drown his wife.
What looks like Scott Fallader drowning Yarmila in the pool, who was already unconscious for whatever reason at the time. So that's when Greg was like, ah, okay, now I know what I'm looking at. And inside he goes and he calls 911. Now, the Phoenix Police Department respond immediately. And they knew that a man was reportedly trying to drown his wife in the backyard pool, a potentially active, life-threatening, like, mm-hmm. situation. So within minutes, officers arrive at the Fallader home. They entered the backyard. And that's when they saw Yarmila floating in the pool, and she was not moving. The water around her was red. It was like she was floating in a pool of blood. Like, it was that red. Actually, one of the officers will go on to say that it looked like a shark attack had happened in the pool.
God.
Like, it was very
vile,
very, very gruesome, like heavily gory scene. So when they took a closer look, it was apparent that Yarmila was already gone. They pulled her out of the pool and they later confirmed that she had been stabbed 44 times.
Whoa.
And then left to bleed out. And then was placed in the water.
But that part wasn't witnessed.
No.
But
nope.
Yep,
exactly. So the officers are all still outside at this point. So they haven't even been inside. They just found Yarmila in the pool and were like, oh my God. So they look in the window and they see Scott Fallader walking down the hallway from the upstairs window. So there's a downstairs and an upstairs in this house. And it looked like he was wearing a white t-shirt and red flannel pajama bottoms. And officers drew their guns and start shouting at him from outside, come outside with your hands up, because he's the only suspect at this point. And it struck them as odd that he did not look frantic. He was just walking. He was very calmly walking around in the house and not responding to any of their commands at all. And it was sort of like, it wasn't like he was trying to hide. He was just going about his fucking business. Not responding to any of them. He even looked a little confused. Like, he even looked like he was kind of, like, looking around, like, looking for something. So it was just, like, his behavior was odd. Mm-hmm. They were like, maybe he's under the influence of something. We're not sure. Police then, like, work their way inside. And then standing at the top of the stairs is a man. It's Scott. And he was calm, but he was clearly very confused. And they start shouting at him to put his hands up. And he's kind of just like, what? Like, what's going on? Like, he's very, very mixed up, very confused, looks utterly baffled. Like, why the fuck are you guys in my house? What is happening? So he followed their commands and he was like, why are you here? Like, what's wrong? What's going on? He's not asking where his wife is. No, he's just like, what?
Uh-huh.
What's going on? And so the police are starting to fire questions at him. Are there other people in the house? Like, do you have kids?
They're screaming at him.
Yeah, they're screaming at him. And he's like, there's three other people in the house. My wife is in here and my two kids are in the house, is what he said. So they already knew that Yarmila, his wife, was dead in the pool. But Scott was acting like he had no clue that his wife was dead in the pool. So immediately they bring him down, they handcuff him, and they place him in the back of the patrol car. He is like pale as a ghost. Like, what is even going on? Like, no one's talking to him except for shouting commands at him. He doesn't know what's going on at this point. So they go inside and they wake up 12-year-old Michael and 15-year-old Megan. And at this point it's like probably between 10 and 11 o'clock at night, I would think.
It's all happened fast.
This is all happening very fast. Yeah. So the kids are told, without much explanation, that their parents had gotten into some kind of argument and that their father had unfortunately killed their mother. And that was all that they were told in that moment. No warning, no comfort, just that their mom, who...
But has he been told his wife's dead yet?
Not really.
Right.
Meanwhile, Scott is being transported downtown to the Phoenix police station for questioning. And what happened during that interview was very bizarre. He was not angry. He didn't seem remorseful. He just was completely baffled, like still very confused and like had clearly no idea what was going on. He repeatedly asked, what happened? What happened? What happened? And he's hearing now that his wife is dead, but he's like, I'm not getting any detail. Like, what happened? How did she die?
What's going on? Why am I here?
Like, yep. So he was shocked when he did finally hear that Yarmila had died, but he said, I don't know what happened to her. Like, I literally don't know what happened to her. He has witnesses that are saying that they saw him drag her to the pool and drown her. So obviously he was trying to harm her, but he is like, I have no memory of doing this. He claimed he had no idea what had happened and that all he remembered was going to bed. All I did was go to bed. So it wasn't until they told him that his neighbor had witnessed him dragging Yarmila's body over to the water and holding her underwater that he began to put the pieces together. And even then, he was not like angry or in denial. He didn't shout at them. He didn't argue. All he said was that I don't remember and that I think I must have been sleepwalking.
Dun, dun, dun!
So he kept saying that same thing. I don't remember. I went to bed.
Did he have a history of sleepwalking?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep. And we'll talk about it. When the police questioned him, he was still wearing his pajamas, a white t-shirt, and those red flannel pajama pants. And what really stood out is that there was a couple of drops of blood, but there was not a lot of blood. There was a tiny bit of blood. It was not obvious. Like, he would not, like, look down. He was not covered in blood by any means. He had a little bit of blood on him. Hold on a second. This is where things get a little funky, right?
Oh, shit.
There was a small Band-Aid on his hand. There was a few small smears of blood, including one on the side of his neck and one on his hand, and I think one on his foot. Everything else was totally clean. His pajamas were clean. So to the police, they were like, okay, you know, obviously you did this and then you changed your clothes, right? Because you can't stab someone 44 times and not have blood on your body.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So there was forensic proof of his guilt just with the one spot of blood on his neck. I mean, that was plenty of evidence to support that that was physical evidence. But Scott, the thing that police were having trouble with the whole sleepwalking story, was that typically, when you're sleepwalking, and we'll talk a little bit more about the details of sleepwalking and what's happening in your brain and like what's typical for a sleepwalking situation. Have you?
When I was a kid.
Really? Mm-hmm. You did? Mm-hmm. I didn't know this about you. I never sleptwalked in my life that I know of.
I was probably, I think I was around 7 or 8 at a sleepover of very close family, very close family friends. And I don't recall anything other than what they told me that I did.
Mm-hmm.
But they told me that I went into the parents' room.
Mm-hmm.
So the parents were the ones telling me this the next day, that I had walked into the parents' room asking, like, where the bathroom was, just other things, telling them that I was hungry, just, like, different things. And they, like, it was nothing, like, alarming. You know what I mean? Mm. Other than the fact that I was just sleepwalking.
Right.
And in the morning, I woke up and I had no recollection of it whatsoever.
Wow.
Yeah.
See, that's crazy to me. The idea of sleepwalking is actually terrifying. And again, we'll get more into it. But like, to me, that's just scary.
I think my son's died once.
Really?
There was one night he also, just like I did, came into our room. And he just like almost like ran in there and just kind of stared at our bed. And then he went back into his room.
That's nightmare fuel.
Yeah.
Kind of. Thanks for that.
Continue.
Kids are scary. Anyway. It seemed to the police that while he's claiming to not remember any of his actions or not be aware of any of his actions, he had the presence of mind to take off his bloody clothes,
really
clean his hands, put a Band-Aid on a wound that he had, and put on fresh pajamas, and then walk around the house a little bit more. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it just seems seems a little different. And yet he claims to remember none of it, but he was present enough in that moment to do those things. That's an important note to remember. Yeah.
He's present enough to clean up the mess.
Yes, exactly. Hmm. Now, at 2:15 a.m., Scott Falater was formally booked and charged with first-degree murder. And photos were taken, fingerprints were processed, forensic techs were, you know, were swabbing, you know, his cheek and getting DNA samples of everything. And DNA did confirm that it was Yarmila's blood that they took off of him. And for the Phoenix Police Department, this was case closed. They had an eyewitness. Mm-hmm. They had physical evidence. Scott Falater murdered his wife and cleaned it up. Simple, right? Pretty cut and dry. But he said he had no memory of the crime. He remembered going to bed. And then the next thing he remembers was waking up to the police inside of his house with guns on him saying, get your hands in the air. And, you know, who else is in the house? And shouting questions at him. And then telling him that his wife is dead.
Can you imagine?
No.
Had the police not come that night, like,
oh my God,
the scene he would have woken up to in the morning.
Oh my gosh. His kids?
Right.
Oh my God. And he's usually the first one to wake in the house in the morning because he leaves so early for the Bible study classes. So it would have been him waking up first. So sad. Now, again, his only explanation is that I must have been sleepwalking. I have no memory of doing any of this. Now, Michael and Megan, the kids, were also interviewed. And they're, again, just teenagers at the time. They're 12 and 14 years old. And they had already suffered unimaginable loss. Mm-hmm. The death of their mother. And now their father is, you know, being accused of killing her. But they were insistent. The kids who lived in that house and spent every waking non-school moment with their parents together said there was nothing unusual that night. There's never anything unusual. There was no recent fights. There's been no screaming matches. There's been no struggle. There's been no signs of physical abuse in the house at all, is what the kids are saying. So they said their parents are loving. They're calm. They're deeply committed to one another. And despite what the police said, both of the kids were standing by their dad. They're like, there's no freaking way this man would brutally murder our mother like this ever. Like, they were like...
I'm so intrigued of the outcome.
Right? This is crazy. So by May of 1999, Scott Falater was sent to go to trial in Maricopa County, Arizona. And the prosecution, led by Deputy Colonel Attorney Luis Martinez, had already made up its mind. Like, they were going to seek the death penalty for this.
Well, because for them, they're like, we have so much hard evidence.
Oh, yeah.
Like, that there's no way.
Yeah. 100. Yeah, absolutely. For them, it's like a slam dunk, right? Mm-hmm. Like, they have everything they need. Scott's defense, though equally firm, were insisting on presenting what would become one of the most controversial defenses in modern criminal history, sleepwalking. Mm. I mean, this is something that barely ever really makes it to trial. So this was a pretty unprecedented situation to actually go before a grand jury with the defense that I was sleepwalking at the time.
Because someone who knows 100% and has the memory that they did it is... If they have that much evidence and the death penalty's on the table, they're probably going to avoid trial because they're just going to plead guilty.
They're just going to
take
guilty.
A life sentence instead of death
penalty.
You know what
exactly.
I mean?
Exactly. They can plead it down. Yeah.
But if he's just like, no way, I absolutely did not like intentionally do this. You know what I mean?
Exactly. That's what makes it so, and it drew intense intense media attention because of that, of that exact thing. Because it's such a shocking claim, you know, how could a person, anybody, stab someone 44 times? I mean, stabbing someone, to me, doesn't sound very easy. Like, taking a kitchen knife and stabbing it into someone, I don't think that's, like, physically easy.
I mean, you've got to go up and use some force, I'd imagine.
You do,
I mean, I know what it takes to try to just cut a chicken.
Right. So. If I'm hand shredding a rotisserie chicken, I'm fucking sweating. Okay. I'm fucking sweating. And for me, the tough part is like he cut his hand. He injured his hand, which is common in when you are stabbing someone because the knife blade gets all covered in blood and slick. Mm-hmm. And then when you try to stab, your hand slides down onto the blade and then you slice your hand open. That's something that happens a lot. And that's what they look for to like as like a
indicator.
Right. So like, and then not only did he not wake up in response to that happening, but he cleaned himself up and he put a fucking Band-Aid on his hand. To me, that's interesting.
I mean, that to me, that's the same as being able to go get a knife, stab your wife to death.
Right. It's all in
the drag her into the water. You know what I mean? Like, it still is takes the same intention. You know what I mean?
You're
like,
right. Yeah. It's just crazy. This whole thing is very, very interesting. So it's like, is that like a reasonable defense? Like, from a forensic standpoint, is that even possible? So like, that's the big thing that the defense had to overcome, was like, we really need to get a firm handle on like what happens during sleepwalking, really get good expert testimony here.
You need facts about it.
Yes,
you need the science
exactly.
behind it.
So a little bit about sleepwalking in general. So sleepwalking or somnambulism is what's called a parasomnia, which is like a type of sleep disorder. And it involves physical behaviors which occur during sleep, such as walking or performing some complex activities. Like, people, you know, have noticed like that they've written something or drawn things, mm-hmm. or even like done some working from home while sleeping, like that you can do, like people sometimes cook things when they're mm-hmm. asleep, which is where things get kind of dicey and dangerous. And it occurs during the deepest phase of sleep, of the non-REM sleep, actually. So typically it will, the onset, like the highest risk period is like 1 to 2 hours after falling asleep. So that actually does check out
up, right?
From a timeline.
About an hour, right?
Yeah, from like a timeline standpoint, that does make sense. And during this stage, the brain is in a partial state of like arousal, meaning that like certain regions that control motor movement are still awake, while the ones responsible for consciousness and memory are not awake. Mm. So it's like the motor stuff is working, but the consciousness and the memory forming part is like not functional right now. So as a result, people will sleepwalk and then move, talk, you know, and seemingly be aware, mm-hmm. but have no recollection afterwards.
Right.
And then like on a chemical level, sleepwalking arises from a dissociation between the sleeping and waking states of the brain. So the frontal cortex, which is what governs decision making and awareness, remains in that sleep state, while the motor control regions, like I said, sort of like wake up and become active enough to produce movement. So there's lots of neurotransmitters that kind of play roles, like serotonin and dopamine. And then research has also suggested that sleepwalkers might actually have abnormal metabolism of certain neurotransmitters like serotonin, like their brains just don't process it in ways like the average person. So there are things that can trigger episodes of happening. So like if you have a history of sleepwalking, mm-hmm. Things like sleep deprivation, irregular sleep schedules, stress and anxiety, both emotional and physical. He was under a lot of stress. Using a lot of alcohol or taking sedatives can trigger an episode. Fever or illnesses, especially in children, can trigger sleepwalking. And then hormonal fluctuations. And there are certain like medical conditions that can predispose you to it, too. Like, I do recall in my setting, we take care of a lot of people with Parkinson's, and we actually have one gentleman who has Parkinson's that has struggled with sleepwalking in his room, that we've had to. I know.
What's that?
I know. So Parkinson's disease can make you prone to sleepwalking. Other things like people who suffer from migraines, which makes sense for you because you're a migraine girly. Mm. And Tourette syndrome and some other neurological conditions, and also certain medications can cause sleepwalking, like certain sedatives. I know that there was a thing about Ambien a while ago. Ambien, right. Or Zolpidem, which is it's a very strong sleep medication that can induce sleepwalking. Mm-hmm. So I've always actually been really like interested, and like I said, like kind of like nervous about sleepwalking in general. It's something that makes me really nervous. Actually, on TikTok, there's a lady, Spooky Boo. Do you know? Oh my God, she is so funny. Okay, so she has actually. Okay, if you don't follow Selena Spooky Boo, it is
I don't even have TikTok.
She is a TikToker, and she kind of like like her early stuff where literally she sleepwalks like all the time, and she put cameras up in her house, and she does hilarious things when she sleepwalks. Like, she says funny things, she just walks around and she just makes silly comments and does silly things and like does funny dances and like talks with her dogs. But there were a couple videos of hers that were kind of scary. She set, because like I said, she sets up cameras and she posts them online. And like, sometimes it's funny, but other times it's scary. There was videos where she actually gets outside and is like walking. And they live on like a street that's like kind of busy. So for me, I'm like, what if you wander into fucking traffic? Or what if you wander into the woods and then you wake up and you're like, where the fuck am I? And I don't have my cell phone or anything on me and I'm in my pajamas. Like, that's scary. Yep. You know what I mean? So for that reason, it like kind of freaks me out. So anyway, that's like just a little bit on sleepwalking. If you're not familiar, like me, I wasn't super familiar with like the mechanism behind it.
Mm. Hey, Kate, guess what?
What?
I am super comfortable right now.
Same.
Oh, you want to know why?
Yep, I do.
Because I'm in my comfort clothes.
Oh my God, me too. I love comfort. Ah!
The holidays are right around the corner.
Literally
five minutes away.
Like, I hear that little Mariah Carey. Hi.
She's unthawing. It's that time of year. We're all looking to restock on some winter cool weather stuff.
Yep.
Don't forget to beef up your cozy weather wardrobe, too.
Yeah, buddy. If you're like me and you're in your cozy girl era, because that is where I live. Comfort is nice because it has options for the whole family. They have men's clothes, they have women's clothes, they have kids, and even furry friends.
The dog! You know, ever since you told me about comfort and I've been exploring in it, I never want to get out of these clothes.
I wash all of my comfort stuff on constant rotation because I get pissed if I have to sleep in anything else or wear a different sweatshirt.
My favorite part is that they're very size inclusive.
Their matching sets come in this variety of weights, the variety of colors. Every single thing that I have gotten has been so high quality.
I love the colors.
Oh,
me too. I'm currently in a mix of the dark, warm green fall color with some light blue pastel. Like,
yes.
I am a season mix right
now. You literally are. I am in the Comfort Pastel Edit, the light pink color in the crew neck sweatshirt, and it is one of my favorites. I wear it all the time. And it's hard to describe, but I have a lot of sweatshirts, okay? Don't at me. But since I've been wearing Comfort, I always reach for these first because they're so soft, they're so comfortable, but they have enough structure that it feels like you're getting a warm hug when you put it on. You know what I mean?
Who doesn't like warm hugs?
Olaf likes warm hugs, and so do I.
This hell does. But I'm really thinking about getting the comfort weighted blanket.
Oh my God, I know. We gotta get some from the Pod Lab, dude.
So not only do they have the clothes, but they have the luxurious blanket as well.
They really do.
And I don't know about any of you, but I love a good weighted blanket.
My next one is gonna be the Travel Essentials hoodie because it has a built-in eye mask, and like, what? You heard me right. There is a built-in eye mask on this bad boy. They have all of the colors. The quality is so high, and it holds up really well over time. I've washed these things, like I said, on constant rotation.
That's my favorite. I hate when my favorite stuff starts to pill.
Yes, these don't do that.
Nope.
These do not do that. They're so functional. They are loaded with pockets, which I love. I gotta have a pocket. You know what I mean? So everything is like not only so comfortable but so functional. You know,
absolutely.
And makes things so easy. And the prices are honestly super affordable. And they're actually having a sale right now. So, yep, GTFO. Get over there.
Get over there.
Get over there.
So, if you want to check out and get your own comfort stuff right before the holiday season, check out www.comfort, that's comfort.com/medcrimes, and get 15% off your purchase.
That is www.comfort.com, comfort.com/medcrimes for 15% off of your purchase.
Go and get snuggly.
Woo!
Do it.
So
I would have assumed you would have been in REM sleep. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't know, I just that deep, but it makes sense. You're
in the pre-REM sleep.
Your body's still awake.
Right.
Your mind is, you know.
Right. Yeah. You're in that special little space where like you're memory and your like awareness is asleep, but like you have enough awakeness that you're...
I wonder if it's more prevalent in men.
That's a great question.
And I only wonder that just because they fall asleep at the drop of a hat while we're like laying in bed worrying about the
world. Because
women
worry and we can't turn our minds off.
Or I mean,
maybe
I
that's
could be
just
in
me.
Bed an hour before my husband.
Mm-hmm.
And he'll come in, kiss me goodnight. I'm still awake. And then he's snoring 2 minutes later. Like, what is this?
I know. I wish that were me. I wish I could just fall asleep very easily. But no, that's not me either. So the prosecution and defense are now both building their cases. And the prosecution, according to them, they were like, this
I'm
was
intrigued
not.
About this defense.
I know.
You know.
Prosecution is like, this was not sleepwalking. This was cold-blooded, calculated murder. Like, that was right. What they were going for.
Of course.
And they had told the jury during the trial that Scott was unhappy in his marriage, that beneath this image of this loving, church-going husband was this man who snapped and decided to murder his wife. And to support that theory, they brought in Dr. Philip Keene, who was the Maricopa County medical examiner. And according to Dr. Keene's testimony, Yarmila Fallader had been stabbed 44 times, like I said. Many of them were defensive wounds, and she had fought. She had tried to stop him.
Oh, my gosh.
She had been very aware. Like, there was evidence that, like, physically she had tried to defend herself, extensively.
You know what else that makes me think of?
Mm-hmm.
These are all my references, people.
I know.
Grey's Anatomy.
Yes.
When Owen Hunt was having his nightmare PTSD and he was choking Christina.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
He was kind of awake. His body was awake because he was choking her, but he has no recollection.
That's right.
It was all part of a dream.
Uh-huh. Yep.
Yeah.
Same exact type of thing, I think. And it's like all probably works on the same level. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So what they argued was that it seemed as though he was more aware than he was letting on, like with the whole sleepwalking thing. Going deeper into the crime itself, the entire attack lasted roughly 15 minutes. This was like a, you know, it wasn't like a split second, like you raise a gun, you pull a trigger, and then you like panic about it. It was like 15 long minutes of physically attacking another person. That's a long time to just go absolute ape shit on another human being. Right. You know what I mean? So this was not like a moment of rage. This was like something bigger than that. So the most damning testimony came from Fallader's neighbor, Greg, because he had told
the jury. He was the eyewitness.
Right. Yeah. He had told the jury that on the night of January 16th, he and his wife had heard disturbing sounds coming from next door. And when he peeked over the fence, he saw that Yarmila was lying motionless on the ground near the pool. And that at the time he was like, maybe she had passed out and needed medical attention, or maybe she had had too much to drink, or, you know, maybe she had tripped and fallen. We don't know. So and then, you know, that he watched Fallader like come out of the house. And he also indicated that he saw Fallader turn the lights off and on a few times inside the house before he came outside, like in the moments before, like the lights were flickering off and on.
Interesting.
And then he saw Scott come out of the house. And one detail that was interesting is that he said he watched Scott put on gloves. So Scott put gloves on. And then he walks over to Yarmila. And then he pushes her into the water. Not only pushed her into the water, but he took her head and he held her head under the water. So like, there does have to be a little bit of awareness and wherewithal. Like, that was the prosecution's argument, was
putting on the
awareness.
Gloves, like he's trying to hide evidence.
Yes.
Like he's
like, whether it was because he had cut his hand and was patching it up.
Right.
And he didn't want to get the Band-Aid dirty. But all of that, I mean, yes, you are capable of some complex things when you're sleepwalking. Right. But according to the medical examiner, he had said, you know, that this sort of just demonstrates a level of awareness that isn't always consistent with sleepwalking. That was his opinion. So that was his testimony for it, which makes sense to me. That makes sense.
Gosh, wow.
So that testimony was very crucial for prosecution. And even Scott couldn't really testify to what happened because, of course, he claimed he had no memory of it. So he really had no way to testify in his own defense. And Greg said something else that made prosecutors even like their case get even a little bit stronger. He had testified that Scott appeared very calm and aware and looked awake during the time, which
he's up moving around.
He's up moving around. So, yeah, like, of course, he would look that way. But the glove thing indicates preparation like that. That's what the prosecution was arguing, that he was like, he wasn't sleepwalking. This was like he was trying to either prevent transfer of evidence or protect his bandaged hand. Either way, he would have needed to have a level of awareness that was higher than that than
That's
sleepwalking.
That's interesting
to me. It is.
I'm trying to put in my brain how it's different than cleaning up, changing your clothes. You know
right.
what I mean? Like, to me, it's just
well,
like, all well,
of that
all part
together.
Of it, you know what I mean? But I'm just, yeah, I mean.
All of that together. Well, that's the thing is that, like, right. you know, because it's such a, something that is not, I mean, sleepwalking as a whole is really not that well understood. Like, despite
yeah.
how well researched it is, it's not well understood. So, like, this was kind of a beautiful defense, honestly, mm-hmm. because, mm-hmm. you know, who are we to say that, you
it
know.
It does kind of plant reasonable doubt.
It really does, a little bit. So, that and the Band-Aid on his hand, another you know, item of proof is what they were saying. They were saying, you know, he was aware enough to look at his wound, assess it, and say, you know, I really should put a Band-Aid on this sucker. And went and got a Band-Aid, cleaned it off, put a Band-Aid over it, and put a glove over his hand. I'm just saying.
It's a good assessment.
Yep. So as for the sleepwalking defense, Luis Martinez told the jury, you know, it was a fantasy. It was a legal gimmick. He said, you don't get to just go murder your wife and then say, oh, I was asleep. So I don't want to face the consequences. You know, I was sleepwalking. That's what they were saying he was trying to do.
Yeah, I mean, the prosecution's trying to do everything,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Exactly.
Of course.
So now it's the defense's turn. And Scott's legal team had one goal. They wanted to prove to the jury that this was not just a cold-blooded murder, that it was a lot more complicated than that. And that this was a medical and forensic mystery. Like, the defense took a very different approach than most. They didn't try to argue that Scott didn't murder his wife. They said, oh, no, he very much did kill his wife. We've got a lot of physical evidence to support that. We're just trying to get to the bottom of, was this intent? Was there intent here? Like, did he actually do this? Or, like consciously? Or, you know, is there, you know, did he... was he not even present in his own body,
right.
basically, when he did this? So Scott and Yarmila were high school sweethearts. They had been married over 2 decades. They raised 2 great kids. They had built this life together. And by all accounts, they were like best friends. You know, there was nobody that had anything bad to say about these two. So it seemed like, you know, this guy was not a guy who was someone who was secretly plotting to kill his wife. He had no history of violence. He had no history of criminal activity. He hadn't, there was never any domestic issues at home, like that the police got involved with. He had never dated anybody else as an adult. I mean, they met as kids and they just stayed together. And he was a devout Mormon. He was a dedicated father to the 2 young kids and a full-time engineer. And like I said, there was no affair that they could find. I mean, they investigated the ins and outs of this. Mm-hmm. Nobody was having an affair. Nobody had taken out any suspicious insurance policies. Nobody had recently had any crazy arguments or been staying with somebody else. Like, there was none of that that mm-hmm. we see sometimes with these murder cases. There was no motive that anybody could really identify.
Mm-hmm.
And from the outside, the Falater marriage looked super solid, super normal. So the question became, like, why?
Like, what would be that?
Right.
What would be the reason?
Exactly. Like, what would make this guy suddenly snap, you know, and like, what was the motive? Like, right. there was no motive. So
what was the prosecution saying the motive was?
They actually didn't really identify a motive. They were just like, we have physical evidence. I mean, they had a solid case.
Of course.
Right?
Of course. But
so really, they didn't have a huge, didn't really have anything. Scott had testified that he actually had a long history of sleepwalking, and there were people like from his medical team, and like it was documented in his medical record that he had a long history of sleepwalking. This was not anything new for him. His legal team actually, because of that, considered the insanity defense, but they pivoted after chatting with his family because the sleepwalking wasn't just a one-off event and it had happened many times since childhood. And technically, it doesn't fall under like the insanity defense, I guess.
Okay.
So his parents and his sister actually ended up testifying that Scott had been sleepwalking for as long as they could remember. And one night as a kid, he came downstairs completely dressed for school at 2 o'clock in the morning. The poor kid.
Yeah.
Another time he walked through the house completely naked, unaware of anything or anyone happening around him.
Hmm.
And every time the following morning, Scott would not remember anything. And eventually it became like a joke. Like, the family would be like, oh, Scott's sleepwalking again. He's, you know, he's just naked and hanging out and just walking around naked. Hey, bud, there's naked, sleepy
so
Scott.
So is he at this point, is is not denying that he did this.
No,
what he's
not
denying
at all.
Is
he's like,
that
obviously I did it.
He's
just like, I can't remember. And I didn't intentionally kill my wife.
It was not the first degree premeditated.
Right. Exactly. So it's like, there goes Scott again, off in dreamland, you know. But the joke suddenly stopped after one of these incidents turned violent. Roughly a month before Scott and Yarmila got married, he was living at home and studying for college finals, and his sister said he was watching the Tonight Show downstairs when Scott suddenly walked into the room from behind her. She asked him what he was doing, but he didn't respond, and instead he walked towards the back door. And that's when she realized, oh, God, he must be sleepwalking again. So she gets up from the couch. She tries to sort of gently, like, keep him in the house, like, block him from exiting the house. So she kind of, like, puts her body in front of the door. And she's standing sort of, like, between the living room and kitchen. And that's when Scott, without saying a single word, grabbed her by both of the shoulders and threw her across the kitchen.
Mm.
And when Scott was made aware of this the following morning, he had no memory. He was like, I'm so genuinely sorry. I don't remember doing that ever. So to the defense, that particular moment was crucial. Like, he has a history of doing this while sleepwalking. This is not, he was violent one time during a sleepwalking episode. And it showed that Scott was capable of complex and violent acts while he was asleep. And they argued that what happened to Yarmila the night of January 1997 was not premeditated. It was not an act of rage. It was a sleep disorder and something that Scott had no control over. So
then I wonder, does that also help the prosecution too? Because then it's like, okay, if you know you have this history of violence with sleepwalking, like, is there anything you can do about that?
I genuinely don't think there is.
You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, do you know what I mean? Like, for the,
I do.
Not just like, I'm just saying, if there was something you could do about it and he didn't do that.
Right. You know, yeah. No, you're right.
That would help the prosecution. But
right. That, like, maybe there was some liability.
Are there
meds
there that you can take to make you not sleepwalk? I don't know.
I actually don't really know that there's a whole lot you can do except for treat the underlying cause if there is one.
Right.
You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I don't know. I'm not familiar enough with sleepwalking to really know that
answer. I feel
like
I watched a movie once where someone was just like, I have to be, like, locked in my room.
Yeah. There are people that barricade themselves.
And, like, you can't do it from the inside because then if I'm in here, I can let myself out.
Yep.
But, like, lock me in from the outside until morning.
Yep.
I'm fully awake.
Exactly. Yep.
Hey.
Yep.
Dicey.
So crazy. So next, the defense would bring in their expert witnesses, sleep specialists, who would help the jury understand the science of the parasomnia and how something so horrific can actually happen while somebody is in a sleepwalking state. There was also non-REM parasomnia, which is a sleep disorder where someone performs complex behaviors during the deepest phase of sleep, sometimes even violent behaviors without being aware of it and not having any memory of it afterwards. There's, like, sort of a subcategory of sleepwalking where you can do that, and the behaviors that people see in that are, like, very complex. So according to them, what they're saying is, like, yes, it is possible that he could have cleaned up the scene. It is possible that he could have put a Band-Aid on his hand and covered up with gloves. He could. That's all very much within the realm of sleepwalking behavior. So one of the leading sleep experts to testify was Dr. Rosalind Cartwright, who was a well-respected sleep researcher from Rush University. And she told the court that sleepwalking can sometimes involve very elaborate behaviors. People can drive cars, use power tools, and even harming somebody. You know, all of that is actually very much possible in an altered state of consciousness. You can't, that's possible. So what triggered these episodes? Again, stress, emotional strain, lack of sleep. These are the three biggest risk factors that can provoke a sleepwalking episode. And especially in people who already have a history of it, like Scott, that was enough for them to say, like, yeah, this was the perfect storm. I mean, he was working very long days. Mm-hmm. He was obviously spread very thin. He had a family. He had a very high demand job. And he was doing all this extra stuff for the church. And it was like, he was spread very thin. So it made sense that he would have had sleepwalking episodes under mm-hmm. this type of circumstance. So colleagues said that he was worried about potentially losing his job. He was assigned this like major project, and this big project was like almost on the verge of collapse. So that was like a really big source of stress for him, too. He was actually concerned that he might even lose his job if things didn't go well. So like mm-hmm. that's another layer, too. Like he was very, very stressed about work, just about work. Sleep experts testify that this type of chronic stress combined with the intense pressure he was under at work and at home likely made Scott especially vulnerable to having an episode of this. And in fact, according to Dr. Cartwright, the night January 16th might have been the perfect storm because you have a man with a known sleepwalking history suffering these high levels of stress, probably not sleeping well. And then there was one like final trigger, which was the frustration of trying to fix the pool late at night. And then that was like the straw that broke the camel's back, you know? And it's also notable that Scott himself told investigators that he had barely been sleeping in the days leading up to the incident. He was exhausted. He had been staying up late, working on all these Bible lessons. Like he said, I hadn't been sleeping like days before. So that actually supported their claim mm-hmm. Because that was a huge risk factor as well. And he said, you know, he felt like he couldn't get the church curriculum just right. It was really bugging him. So the defense's theory is that lack of sleep, the stress, the lifelong sleep issues, everything just converged that night. And it was like, the perfect storm. Mm-hmm. So it caused Scott to sleepwalk and commit this horrible, violent crime that he had no memory of. And so to back it up, the defense actually had Scott undergo a sleep study while he was in custody. And doctors would monitor his brain activity overnight. And sure enough, Scott experienced abnormal arousals from deep sleep consistent with somebody who would be prone to sleepwalking. So that was like actual mm-hmm. measurable data to support, like, yes, this man does have these features.
Well, that's helping the defense case.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, 100%. For sure. Yep. So was he sleeping when he committed one of the most violent spousal murders the city of Phoenix had ever seen? Like, as the trial wrapped up, both sides gave their closing arguments. And it was clear that this case had really surprised the jury because it seemed like they kind of went in knowing the facts and being, you know what I mean? But then, like, as everything unfolded, it was like, how the fuck are we supposed to make a decision? Uh-huh. You know what I mean? Like, they had this gruesome forensic evidence, and the wife stabbed you. Calm down, woman.
I know, my tummy.
I know. So the jury was made up of everyday people. There were some people were parents themselves, many of whom were like very shaken by the case. And reporters in the courtroom noted that during the closing arguments, a lot of the jurors actually were like looking very uncomfortable. And like they would, of course, show the autopsy photos again. And a lot of people were like looking away. I mean, it was very gruesome. Mm. It was really, you know, it was awful. So it just really like stuck with them. Like even if Scott had sleepwalked through the entire thing, how could they explain like everything that they did afterward? Like they were having a lot of trouble sort of reconciling all of that.
There's still a whole lot of questions.
There are so many questions. Just, yeah. Yep. They did end up finding the bloody knife and his bloody clothes in his car. So he had gone into the house, he had changed his clothes, brought the dirty clothes into his car.
Right.
Then gone back into the house.
So it's like...
So it's a lot of questions, right? We don't know. Like, again, and he's putting on the gloves. All of that just felt intentional. But again, there are experts on both sides testifying that either scenario is well within the realm of possibility.
Right.
So it's hard to say. They deliberated over 20 hours over the course of 4 days, and the jury returned with a verdict guilty of first degree murder. Of course, we knew he was guilty. We knew he physically did it. And when the verdict was read aloud, Scott showed very little emotion because he had, I mean, already very much come to terms with the fact that he had done this and that he was not planning on not going to jail. I mean, he knew that was going to happen. His children, who had been seated in the gallery, were devastated, of course. They had already lost their mom, and now they were essentially losing their dad, too. And despite prosecutors seeking the death penalty, the jury did not sentence Scott to death. Instead, he was given life in prison without the possibility of parole.
Wow.
So, in interviews after the trial, jurors said that they believed Scott's sleepwalking story was real, but ultimately it didn't justify what happened to Yarm, right? So, like, One juror told reporters, quote, maybe he started out sleepwalking, but there was a moment somewhere in there where maybe he woke up and instead of stopping, he just kept going. Like, that's the thing, is that it's so hard to be sure either way. You know what I mean? Like, you can't.
I would hope that, like, I agree with that. Like, you know, that somewhere along the way, did he realize, like, after the drowning or
and then
whatever,
panic and try to clean things up? Like, that would make more sense.
But also just with the way that he was acting when they came in, I feel like who he was, at least.
It seemed like he was waking up.
But what I'm saying is like, at least who he seemed to be from to the outside world prior to this event, he was of high moral character.
Yes.
Like, so I don't think he would pretend, like when the cops showed up, you know what I mean? Like, and not, I don't know.
It's crazy. It's crazy to think about this being possible. You know what I mean? This story obviously was a media sensation at the time. And I actually remember, I think, seeing things about this in the news and hearing.
Really?
Vaguely.
I mean,
vaguely.
We were so young.
Oh, yeah. We were young. Yeah. But I vaguely remember hearing about this. Wow. Definitely. Headlines like the sleepwalking killer and nightmare in suburbia ran in newspapers and TVs across the country. And there were true crime shows like 2020.
I'm sure Lifetime's made a movie about it.
Of course. Dateline, 48 Hours, everything ran detailed specials about it because everybody wanted to know more.
Everybody likes a different story.
They do, you know? Yeah. And the case even appeared in psychological journals and legal analyst pieces due to the like unusual defense and the crazy circumstances around the case. Many members of the public really couldn't wrap their heads around it. Could someone really be capable of doing this to someone that they love, like, just because they're sleepwalking? Right. It's crazy. And, like, people are looking at their partners who they know sleepwalk and are like, are you just going to fucking kill me one day?
Oh, shit.
Like, one day you're not just going to walk into the kitchen and throw a frying pan. You're actually going to murder me. Like, that's terrifying, actually. Right. Like, it's very terrifying to think about. Is this a man who, like, I mean, there was a lot of, like, talk about, like, is this a guy who just got away from the death penalty with this defense of I was sleepwalking and it's complete bullshit, you know? It's possible.
It is.
You know, it's something that we just will never know.
I would think that, though, if he was that type of a douche, they would have found more skeletons in his closet.
You would think so.
Because I'm sure
there would have been some financial thing.
It was a year and a half before they went to trial with all of the DNA evidence that they still had. Like,
yes.
I feel like the prosecution was like, would have found some shred of potential motive.
Yeah. You would have think that, like, maybe he was having an affair. Or maybe he was up to his eyeballs in gambling debt and he needed an out and wanted to kill his wife for the insurance money.
Who knows?
You know, you would think that there would be something, but they found nothing.
Right.
They found nothing.
Right.
So, like, it's just crazy to think about. Experts are also still split on this. Like, there are still some psychologists looking back on this and saying, like, sleepwalking as a defense for murder is a dangerous and slippery slope. Like, they feared that it would set a precedent where criminal defendants might say, oh, I don't remember, I was sleepwalking, you know, in order to get away from an incident or escape responsibility. But others, you know, would point to legitimate past cases. Like, there was a gentleman named Kenneth Parks in Canada who was acquitted after killing his in-laws in a sleepwalking state to show that the science could back it up, like, in theory. Like, this guy was acquitted from a double murder that he claimed he was sleepwalking during.
Oh, boy.
So it's crazy.
That's another layer to that insanity defense.
It does.
For sure.
It does. And there was a lot of people that voiced sympathy for Scott as well as heartbreak for, you know, his two kids who were now without both of their parents. And it's just, it's like kind of a rage-inducing situation. To this day, the case is studied in law schools.
Really?
Yes, and psychology programs and
That's
by
cool.
true crime communities, because it's forced a
That's
lot of
cool.
people to sort of think about some pretty, like, uncomfortable questions. Like, how well do we really know the people we love? Is my husband, who I know sleepwalks, going to just bludgeon me to death one day because he's sleepwalking?
This is a medical mystery that we have not talked about.
I know. See? Med-crime.
Med-crime.
Yep.
It was all brought back.
Exactly. So, and then the other question is, like, how guilty is a person when they're unconscious? Like, this person is unconscious. Yes, physically, his body carried out all of these actions. But if we can prove that they were unconscious, literally unconscious, How much culpability is there?
Let's say, so some of the reasons the jurors still found him with the first degree is because of what could have potentially been, like, intentional. So, like, I don't want to give anyone out there who's potentially a murderer any ideas.
Oh, I know.
But, like, would it have been better had she had been left in the pool and he went to bed with all the bloody clothes on?
Yes. And like you said, so many layers, so many unanswered questions, you know? He's now in his 60s. He's never wavered once from his original story, by the way. Never once. He's given several interviews and every single time has told the exact same story, that he has no memory of the killing and that he was sleepwalking.
What a life to live behind
bars. I know, right? Right? So his two kids, just teenagers at the time, have stood by their father this entire time, publicly stating they don't believe that he would ever knowingly hurt their mom, ever. And, like, they forgive him. They're like, I could never, like, hold him personally responsible for this, you know, which is so, like, so profound and so brave from those kids, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So there have been a handful of cases. I mentioned one, but there's been a handful throughout our legal history in which assailants claim to have been sleepwalking during the commission of a crime. And 1846 is actually the earliest known case where sleepwalking was used as a murder defense. Albert Jackson Terrell was accused of killing Maria Bickford in Boston by slashing her throat and setting fires to cover it up. His lawyer argued that Terrell had a lifelong tendency to sleepwalk and that he may have committed the act completely unconsciously.
Wow.
So despite the violent and deliberate nature of the scene, the jury found him not guilty, accepting the sleepwalking defense, a groundbreaking decision given the lack of medical understanding at the time.
Wow.
And then there's Fane versus the Commonwealth in 1879 in Kentucky. And this 19th century case, a man asleep in Kentucky in a hotel lobby shot someone after being startled awake. So he was holding a gun and, like, he had gotten up and sleepwalked and he was startled and just shot someone. And he claimed that to have been sleepwalking during the shooting, initially convicted of manslaughter. His charge was later reduced when the court reevaluated the evidence and considered his possible unconscious state during the act. There's R.V. Lowe in 2005 in Manchester, UK. After a night of drinking, Jules Lowe beat his elderly father to death, and he claimed complete amnesia and a history of sleepwalking. And despite skepticism from experts about the repetitive nature of the attacks, the jury found him not guilty by reason of insanity, ordering an indefinite hospitalization rather than imprisonment for him. So these cases just kind of highlight that complex, sort of case-specific judgments determine the success of a sleepwalking defense. And courts tend to acquit when there's strong medical evidence that show genuine unconsciousness, but it's not always that easy, like in this case, you know? Because there's some evidence that suggests, like, yes, he was sleepwalking. It seems very genuine. And then other moments where it's like, I don't know.
Right.
You know?
Yep.
I don't know.
Gosh.
So that's the crazy sad story about the Fallader family.
So many questions.
I know. This poor, wonderful wife and mom of two.
This was a very unique idea, though, to do during our spooky season.
Well, it kind of has, like, that vibe, you know? I don't know. It's just like that, like, unsettling, mysterious, sort of just uncomfortable. I just revel in the discomfort, baby. Just fucking lay it out there. Lay it on.
That sounds scary.
I know.
Thanks for listening, everyone.
Yar.
If you want to check us out, you can go on Facebook at Med Crimes Podcast.
You can find us on YouTube by searching Med Crimes Podcast.
Go to Instagram and search Med Crimes Podcast.
If you want to become a Patreon, you can find us at www.patreon.com/MedCrimesPodcast. We're so fun. Just
you can
send
us any crazy stories, suggestions, anything you want. Just say hi.
Yep.
At medcrimes@gmail.com.
Stay safe out there.
And don't sleepwalk.